When was this taken?
All at once, his voice sounded as brittle as splintering slates.
The Wednesday before Valentino died.
And you never said a word to me about it all this time.
Good God, Vito. It wasn't until yesterday that I noticed the two of them were in the photo.
He gave her a puzzled look.
But you took the damn thing.
She rolled her eyes.
My God, I snapped the vigile. I didn't notice that Valentino and Mr. X were there until last night.
The vigile? Why him?
Oh, Vito, it's a long story and certainly no grounds for jealousy. So what do you say?
The commissario said nothing. He picked up the photo at last, though only with his fingertips, and studied it closely.
It's the truth, Vito,
Poldi insisted.
I didn't notice the two of them at the time. But look at the startled expression on their faces. What if I accidentally photographed Valentino's murderer?
Montana looked up at her.
What then?
Then I could be in danger.
Is that why you invited me here tonight?
Salty, bitter, sharp. His tone of voice suddenly combined them all, and Poldi thoroughly disliked that fact.
I could offer myself as bait.
It was supposed to sound jocular, but it didn't. It sounded despairing. Montana thought for a moment. Then he rose and pocketed the photo.
Thanks for dinner. I'll call you.
That put paid to phase three. The commissario hurried to the door before Poldi could even get to her feet. She tottered after him with legs like mozzarella and got there just in time.
Vito, wait! This is ridiculous.
He looked at her.
Ridiculous, you say?
No. Yes, I mean...
She got no further. For Montana, halfway out into the street, which smelt of jasmine and cat's piss, suddenly bent forwards, drew my Auntie Poldi to him, and kissed her. He kissed her as desperately and greedily as a drowning man, and as gently as summer rain.
Or so Poldi felt.
It was a lingering kiss, and she didn't hesitate to respond with all her might. She could smell him, feel his breath, feel his hands around her neck and on her hips, feel his chest against hers, and more. There it was. Poldi found it undeniably sweet. And for the first time for ages, she felt complete again, entirely herself and alive. When she tried to pull him back into the house, however, he gently released himself.
"Good night,"
he said in a low, hoarse voice, and went. My Auntie Poldi was beside herself.
Perhaps he was just, well, shy,
I hazarded when she told me about it on my next visit in September.
Shy? Montana, are you mad?
Or perhaps he simply wasn't that far along.
What the hell does that mean?
Relationship-wise, I mean. He wouldn't be the first. Perhaps it was all happening too fast for him. I mean, perhaps he felt you'd somehow, well...
Felt I'd somehow what?
Well, rushed him. Emotionally, I mean.
She stared at me with her mouth open.
You know why you haven't got a girlfriend, don't you? Because you don't know the first thing about a woman's emotions. Rushed him? What bullshit! He pounced on me. He was overwhelmed by his own passion. I felt it, that fire, that magma rising in his volcano. I'm an expert on these things. The frigid way he simply cleared off, that was thoroughly calculated. He was jealous on account of the Vigile's photo.
Passionate and calculated, I was bold enough to ask. How do you reconcile the two?
Why, yin and yang, id and superego, get it? Heart and brain. The man is a detective chief inspector, and a detective chief inspector is the supreme alpha male, a perfect synthesis of emotion and reason.
If you say so.
No need to say if you say so in that oh-so-clever way. I know precisely what I'm talking about. You can't imagine how furious I was. Fancy leaving me standing in the doorway, the heartless block of ice. I'd have taken him on a magic carpet ride that night, introduced him to a host of erotic marvels and adventures.
This was rather too much information for me. I gave a sheepish cough.
And now you're embarrassed, aren't you? That's just why you're getting so constipated with that novel of yours. Because you always look away when it hurts. You're scared of emotion.
Yes, well, it's getting rather late. Good night, Poldy.
Stay where you are and look at me. What do you see?
I sighed.
Go on. What do you see?
You, Poldy.
No, under the surface.
I looked at my Auntie Poldy in her ethnic caftan, with her wig slightly askew and her makeup reminiscent of an Egyptian pop singer. She was holding a nearly empty glass of whiskey in her hand, but had stopped drinking.
Disappointment?
She shook her head.
Deeper.
Pain, I said.
Love?
Longing.
And the reason?
I drew a deep breath.
In second place, Montana.
She knit her brow.
Aha. And in first place?
Sicily. The pain of feeling that Sicily doesn't return your love as enthusiastically as you thought it would. And the hankering to finally feel at home here. That's what I know something about. Poldy drained her glass and continued to look at me intently. Her expression conveyed that I wasn't, after all, a totally forlorn hope. Or so I told myself.
Sleep well.
Then, mustering her strength, she heaved herself off the sofa and tottered bedroomwards. My Auntie Poldy was definitely feeling hurt, and no wonder, especially as Montana failed to call her the next day. The other aunts, filled with Latin solidarity, were unstinting in their condemnation of the commissario's foul play. Their unanimous opinion? There must be another woman in Montana's life. He wasn't worth it, of course, not after toying with Poldy's emotions like that. But if she were to bring herself to give him another chance despite this, she would be bound to succeed in the long run. That was a copper-bottomed certainty.
"Forza, Poldy," cried Aunt Louisa. "What other woman could hold a candle to you?"
"A younger one?" Poldy croaked darkly.
"Nonsense," cried Caterina. "You've got good skin, a firm backside, and you're fun."
"I'm old and fat."
"You're an armful of a woman in her prime."
Poldy cast her eyes up at the ceiling. Aunt Teresa summoned Uncle Martino.
"Amore, tell Poldy what she is."
"The loveliest of all Isolde's."
"Bravo, there you have it."
But Poldy didn't find genuine consolation until she flung herself into the arms of Signor Bacardi. They did it together sour, on the rocks, with coke and with tonic, sweet and sour, salty and bitter. Even on the way downhill she made Sicily another defiant declaration of love. But alcohol is a perfidious plank in the ocean of self-pity.
"It keeps you afloat for a while. Saves you from drowning and infects you with optimism, but then it drags you down, glug, 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 into the depths."
Poldy knew what she was talking about.
So what saved her from the nadir of self-pity? Love? Joie de vivre?
Wrong. Her hunting instinct. Her forensic urge. The photograph of Valentino with Mr. X. Hungover, thirsty, devoid of appetite, and ill-tempered, the first thing she did on the morning after her fall from grace was check her answer phone. Still no word from Montana, just worried messages from Valerie and the aunts. Montana didn't call for the next few days either, but Poldy had her pride. She was now eager to solve this murder, if only to show him up and make him look foolish, make him look one big figuraccia. Pale and still a bit under the weather, she showed the photo on her mobile around town. To Busaca at the Debacchi, to the sad signora, to the neighbours, but nobody seemed to recognise the red-haired man.
"There was this police psychologist on Channel 5's Faces of Crime,"
Signora Analzone volunteered in her habitually conspiratorial whisper.
He said murderers always return to the scene of the crime. They can't help themselves. They're driven there by their feelings of guilt, their curiosity and arrogance.
Spot on, thought Baldy, puzzled that the same idea hadn't occurred to her long ago. She thought it improbable that Mr. X would show up on the beach at Priola, however. It was likelier, especially as he didn't seem to avoid crowds of people, that she would bump into him in Taormina. He might even live there. Poldi promptly called Teresa, because she naturally knew that proper surveillance, whether of a person or a thing, is always maintained by two people. Two pairs of eyes see better than one, and one member of the team can always take a break. Besides, it can be a terribly boring business, and experience had taught Poldi that boredom and hard liquor go hand in hand.
Keep watch on the whole of Taormina? How'd you propose to do that?
Mainly the Corso, but other hot spots as well.
Around the clock?
Of course not. I'll split us up into 3 shifts of 4 hours. That makes 12. We can't manage more.
How about recruiting Martino?
This kind of surveillance wouldn't suit someone who can't sit still for 10 minutes at a time. Besides,
yes, I know, but how will you stick it for 12 hours?
My time's my own.
But Louise's isn't. She has to work.
Only half days. She can take over the evening shift. She might even meet someone.
Stop it. You know how jealous Franco gets. And who'll look after Caterina's dogs and collect little Carmela from nursery school?
Martino?
You must be joking.
Poldi could hear her sister-in-law breathing heavily as she ran the whole idea through her mind again.
Perfect. If we solve the case, the Terranovas will eat their plastic flowers with envy.
It was unnecessary to ask the other two sisters, because, as I've already mentioned, Aunt Teresa called the shots, and all the aunts were fans of police procedurals. Picturesquely situated, overlooking the sea, Taormina is one of Sicily's favourite tourist haunts. Goethe visited there, as did Oscar Wilde and Thomas Mann, followed by film stars like Greta Garbo, Marlene Dietrich, and Elizabeth Taylor. In the middle of the town is a Roman amphitheatre, misleadingly called the Teatro Greco, at which top-class film festivals, concerts, and ballets take place during the summer. Mind you, there is always a risk that some international star will be upstaged by a volcanic eruption, for a gap in the middle of the stage affords a splendid view of Etna. In the 19th century, a German photographer named Wilhelm von Glöden, who landed up in Taormina because of lung disease, photographed local youths striking lascivious poses in front of ancient columns, well made up and naked save for a loincloth or a laurel wreath. Prints of these photographs can be bought on every street corner in Taormina, and they help to establish the liberal reputation of the town, which is still a favourite domicile of the gay community. Poldi and Caterina, who had taken over the early shift, seated themselves outside the Mocambo bar the very next morning. Not too conspicuously far forward, and not too far back. Sometimes in the shade, sometimes wearing sunglasses, with a good view of the piazza and the corso. Still a little tense for the first hour, Poldi drank one coffee after another in her determination not to miss a single man who walked past. After an hour she was worn out and had cramp in her neck. It surprised her to note that Caterina, on the other hand, was sitting there quite relaxed in her stylish sunglasses, legs elegantly crossed. She turned her head smoothly and serenely to and fro like a radar dish, seemingly uninterested, yet no one escaped her attention.
2 o'clock, the one with the rucksack? Too short. 11 o'clock, just coming out of that shop. Too young. Hey, how do you manage it?
Caterina shrugged.
Just pretend we're teenagers again. Remember how we used to check out the boys without them noticing?
Except that I always wanted them to notice.
Just relax, Poldi.
Easier said than done. Poldi did get the hang of it after a while, though. She melted into her surroundings and imitated Caterina's radar sweep. The only trouble was, Mr. X failed to surface amid the never-ending stream of faces that flowed down the corso under the two aunts' gaze. German families in clam diggers, scruffy young backpackers in flip-flops, hand-holding English gays, American youngsters with coffees to go, boisterous children romping around the piazza, chic Spanish ladies with strident voices, good-humoured, sunburnt Dutchmen, old men chatting in groups, pallid priests carrying briefcases, locals in a hurry and leisurely businessmen. As though propelled by strange tidal forces, this ever-murmuring, shuffling stream flowed back and forth between Porta Messina and Porta Catania, meandered into side streets, eddied sluggishly around street painters' easels, and debouched into the Piazza Duomo, where photos were taken, sandwiches munched, and the view enjoyed. And all of this monitored and commented on by Poldi and the other aunts. In the meantime, Poldi's mobile beeped almost hourly with text messages from Montana. Call me. Where are you? Can we talk? Please call. The sorts of messages that rent her heart made the position unmistakably clear that it was over before it had begun. With a bitter taste in her mouth, Poldi deleted all these messages and blocked Montana's number. She felt a little better after that. Caterina was relieved around noon by Teresa, and Luisa took on the evening shift late in the afternoon. Poldi and her cheerful assistants changed cafes frequently so as not to be too conspicuous. They drifted across the Corso in the crowds, consumed an ice cream here, a panino, orange juice, iced tea, coffee or pastry there. Anything but alcohol. Not even a little prosecchino or a tiny limoncello as a sundowner. It was a genuine struggle, but Poldi remained steadfast. No alcohol, and finding Mr. X was her plan. Except that Mr. X didn't cooperate. Poldi knew, of course, that the success of a stakeout depends on two factors. Patience and stamina. One has to emulate the gecko, which crouches on a rock, rigid and motionless, awaiting the moment when it can unexpectedly pounce on its prey. She did spot the vigile again, but he had long since to interest her. On the contrary, she now found him far less attractive, positively conceited, affected and stupid-looking. Not to be compared with Montana. Worlds apart, in fact. Ah, yes, Montana. Whenever she thought of him, a little ache detached itself from her heart like scree breaking adrift from a mountainside and sliding into the valley with a lingering sigh.
"Forget about him," said Aunt Louisa. "Look around you. This place is teeming with hundreds of good-looking men in their prime."
Poldi made a dismissive gesture.
"They're all gay. Not from the looks they're giving us. Giving you, you mean? You really think so?"
"You're hot," Poldi said earnestly.
"As an inconspicuous assistant on a stakeout, you're almost useless."
Louisa beamed.
"Franco would blow a gasket if he heard that. Have you any idea how long I've been wanting to do something like this? I mean, go out and about again, mix with people, chew the fat, have a little adventure, maybe indulge in a harmless flirtation."
She grasped Poldi's hand and squeezed it.
"I'm so glad you're here."
But one swallow doesn't make a summer, and even the most diligent stakeout failed to come up with Mr. X. After 3 days of shift work in Taormina, the aunts were running out of steam and even Poldi was feeling rather jaded. A mass of thoughts whirled through her head when she came home late at night and sank down exhausted on the sofa. Thoughts of a certain policeman, of Valentino, of Luisa's words, of the topographical map, of Mr. X, of Valerie and Russo, even of her parents. Sentimental thoughts of opportunities missed, precious time squandered and botched goodbyes. It was in this state of mind that she received a letter from Tanzania, which she burned, unopened, in the ashtray. And then, out of the blue next evening, Montana arrived in the Corso Umberto. Poldi had just paid the bill and left her usual generous tip, so she was temporarily distracted.
That's the thing about stakeouts. Something always happens just when you aren't looking.
When she did look up, he was standing beside her table in his creased grey work suit. His grumpy face lit by the setting sun. He might have been magicked there by some genie with a taste for bad jokes. He shook hands with Aunt Louisa and introduced himself. It was all Louisa could do not to beam at him, because that would have been bad form without Poldy's all clear.
"I'll leave you two alone together,"
she managed to say without grinning, and hurriedly withdrew, though not without giving the commissario an appraising glance. Montana sat down on the vacant chair. No kiss, no word of greeting.
"What are you doing here, Poldy?"
"I could ask you the same thing. How did you find me?"
Montana shrugged.
"Mobile phone tracking."
Poldy was speechless for a moment.
"You mean I'm still under suspicion?"
"Why don't you answer your phone? Why didn't you respond to my texts?"
She looked at him.
"Because we've nothing to discuss, Vito. And, my dear, because I've been busy."
Montana looked even more downcast than before.
"What are you doing here, Poldy?"
"Just sitting. It isn't against the law, is it?"
"All day long?"
"No, just at the moment."
Montana shook his head.
"We had an agreement, Poldy."
"Yes, thanks for the reminder and goodbye," she growled in German.
"What?"
"Our agreement concerned Russo, and I've kept it. Have you discovered the identity of Mr. X?"
He shook his head.
"Have you?"
Poldy rose from her chair with a sigh.
"It's getting late. I must go home."
And, because she couldn't resist, seeing him so downcast, she gave him a little pat on the head.
"So long, Vito between two stools."
"I'll call you," said Montana.
And Poldy actually managed to smile.
"Whenever it's convenient."
She left the café without once looking round and collected Aunt Louisa, who had been loitering in front of a shop window.
"My, he's sexy,"
Louisa whispered.
"I don't want to talk about him."
Louisa nodded.
"Of course not. He is sexy, though."
"Louisa, I was only saying."
Poldy pulled herself together. She went to the multi-story with Louisa, paid for her ticket in the machine, found her alpha, sat behind the wheel for a moment, and only then wept a little. Only a little, because she didn't really have much time for self-pity, but there are occasions when one just can't help it. Not even my Auntie Poldy could. So she shed a tear or two, and Louisa held her hand the whole time and kept saying,
"There, there, Poldy."
Mr. X didn't show up the following day either. But that evening, Poldy was overtaken by her past in the shape of an old acquaintance. Black leather suit, shades, rings on every finger. He was on his own. No one had recognized him. No one was hassling him for an autograph. He simply walked down the Corso, spotted my Auntie Poldy, and sat down at her and Louisa's table.
"Why, Ringo!"
Poldy cried, profoundly touched, and threw her arms around him.
"Just a minute,"
I interrupted suspiciously when she described the scene in detail on my next visit in September.
"Ringo who?"
"Why, Ringo Starr, of course."
"We don't mean the Ringo Starr."
"I was surprised myself that he recognized me after all those years, but he homed in on me as if it was only yesterday when Pepe and I had a meal with him and his Barbara. Such a nice couple, those two."
I stared at her.
"I don't believe you."
"Don't then."
"What did Ringo Starr want?"
"Nothing. A bit of a chat, that's all. How was I, and how was Pepe doing? He didn't know that Pepe wasn't with us anymore, you see. We completely lost touch. Oh, yes, and he wanted to know what I was doing in Sicily. He promptly started to flirt with Louisa, and he invited us to his open-air concert at the Teatro Greco the following night. Backstage, of course."
"Of course."
"And then he said we'd be welcome to visit his house in Surrey any time we got sick of our Mediterranean paradise. The winters there were so splendidly dank and dreary."
"Wonderful, darling," I told him. "We'll give it some thought." "And what do you think I did then?"
"You showed him the photo of Mr. X."
"Cento punti." "And just imagine, Ringo recognized him."
Chapter 8 Tells of Inspector Chance and how Poldy discovers the identity of Mr. X with his help. She has to swallow her pride several times in quick succession, and she isn't the only one. She gets a lecture on aerodynamics, is able to hold Montana's hand and eat a dumpling, and eventually has every reason to feel satisfied. One of the most successful investigators in the whole history of crime since Oedipus, Poldy knew, is Inspector Chance. No case has ever been solved without him, and he's always needed at some stage. Poldy liked to picture Inspector Chance as an ill-shaven slob whose mother still does his washing. Trainers, old jeans, scruffy hoodie, nerd glasses, never really grown up. An unreliable colleague with no particular ambition except in regard to his work-life balance. He does the minimum of work in his office at the far end of some corridor, where the air smells of cleaning fluids and stale coffee. A cubbyhole where junk and old files are stored, and he's sometimes simply forgotten. That's all right with Inspector Chance, just as long as no one bugs him and he can work at half speed ahead. He seldom shows his face at departmental meetings or operational briefings, on the firing range or in the field. He prefers to be warm and cozy. No stress. If he's hassled, he simply clams up. If prevailed on to process a file at the start of a case, for instance, Inspector Chance can be relied on to send the investigation down the tubes. Inspector Chance has a problem with authority. He's moody and has a mordant sense of humour. An only child, Poldy surmised. No wonder Inspector Chance isn't popular with his colleagues, who tirelessly compile facts and leads and toil away in order to render him redundant. Given his lax work ethic, he should have been kicked out long ago, public servant or no. Ironically enough, however, Inspector Chance can point to some notable successes. Completely belying his puny appearance, he can pounce with unexpected speed and precision, can unravel knotty problems, collate leads and shine a light on hidden mysteries. He is needed, and he knows it. On the other hand, he never complains if colleagues deck themselves with his laurels. He's quite relaxed about it. He usually profits from their meticulous spadework after all, so he expects no thanks. A little namaste, at most, and Poldy made sure to give him one. Namaste, Inspector Chance. Namaste, Ringo. Ringo had already spent a week in Taormina for the concert and a video shoot. In keeping with his status, he was staying at the Timeo, the best hotel in town, and it was in the lobby of that luxury establishment that he had seen Mr. X deep in conversation with someone. Ringo had recognized that someone as a person to be avoided, after being buttonholed and bullied into accepting his business card the day before. That was why Ringo remembered Mr. X. And because he had heedlessly pocketed the business card and forgotten it instead of throwing it away, he was able to give it to my Auntie Poldy. The business card was that of Corrado Patané. "Well, well, well," I exclaimed when she told me. I was impressed. "That surprised you, didn't it?" "Yes, but you only win the lottery if you buy a ticket."
"So you hurried over to the Timeo and made inquiries, of course."
"It was the logical thing to do, but I might have known that they wouldn't give me any information about a guest, the smartasses. They wouldn't even tell me if Mr. X was a guest."
"They'd probably have told Montana, though."
"Yes, I thought of that, naturally."
"So what stopped you?"
"Her pride, of course. My aunt was determined to solve this case on her own and then rub Montana's nose in it. To hell with him. But Poldy also knew that she mustn't push her luck too far. Inspector Chance was capricious, and he liked to knock off early sometimes. Her persevering stakeout had rewarded her with a lead. Namaste, Inspector Chance. Namaste, Ringo. But how to proceed further?
She could, of course, seek out Patané and ask him point-blank about Mr. X. The surprise effect might even elicit an honest answer.
But it was likelier that Patané would flatly deny having seen or even met him, let alone known him personally.
After all, the sole weapon in Poldy's armory was an old acquaintance's recollection of a fleeting encounter several days ago. And besides, Ringo was no spring chicken, and his memory might not be entirely reliable on account of his widely publicized, though decades old, prior history in regard to the consumption of mind-expanding substances. Fundamentally, therefore, Mr. X was still a phantom, and possibly Valentino's murderer. and consequently a potential risk to Poldy. She could, of course, run the risk of entering the lion's den alone and wait for Mr. X at the Timaeo. But my aunt had never been one to let pride and vanity stand in her way when the chips were down. The solving of this case was her top priority, even if she had to swallow her pride. And Poldy knew a thing or two about swallowing one's pride. With a sigh, she unblocked Montana's number in her mobile phone and sent him a text. "Can you come to the Timaeo? It's important." Pling, plong, pling. The reply came back at once. "Now? Poldy. Please." Then she sent Aunt Louisa home and waited for Montana. Less than an hour later, from a comfortable sofa right at the back of the lobby, she saw him enter the luxury hotel and look around for her. She savored the sight for a moment before she waved to him, feeling a familiar tension permeate her body as she did so, the sort of tightening of the skin that's a prelude to sunburn, a presentiment of the special pain for which one yearns on lonely nights.
"Tell me,"
she said once he had sat down beside her,
"have you made a vow or something?"
"Meaning what?"
"Well, to go on wearing that awful grey suit on duty until it hangs off your body in rags and tatters."
Montana's face creased in a sour smile. "Is that why you sent for me?"
"No."
Squaring her shoulders, Poldy gave him a succinct account of her investigation to date. Montana didn't interrupt her once, just knit his brow briefly at the mention of Ringo. Then, without a word, he rose and went over to the reception desk. Poldy saw him show his ID to the snotty youth with gelled hair behind the counter, saw the snotty youth raise his hands defensively, saw Montana add something to which the snotty youth clearly took great exception, saw a manager summoned and his fingers speed over a keyboard, whereupon, quite magically and unbureaucratically, a printout slid out of the printer and was discreetly handed to the commissario, with a look of indignation. Montana signalled to Poldy that he would be busy for a little while longer, and put in a call on his mobile, pacing up and down the lobby as he did so. Poldy found that she enjoyed watching him pace up and down, even in that eternally crumpled suit. After a while, he closed his mobile and came over to her.
"There's good news and bad news. The good news is we know who the man is. A Dr. Frank Tannenberger. Lives in Munich."
Munich, of all places. Poldy heaved a sigh of surprise.
"He flew back the day before yesterday," Montana added.
"And the bad news?"
Montana looked harassed.
"It's a crock of shit. The man is a senior official in the,
He glanced at the printout.
Bayerischer Staatskanzlei?
He almost dislocated his tongue pronouncing the words.
"What the hell's that?"
"A kind of department of the Bavarian state government."
"What do you mean, state? I thought Bavaria was a German province."
"Are you crazy? We're a Freistaat, a free state. We could go independent any time we choose and do our own thing. Federally speaking, and in spaghetti Western terms, the Bavarian Free State is a loaded colt pointed at the heart of Germany."
"I see. Anyway, this Dr. Tannenberger visits Taormina regularly on official business and always stays at the Timaeo. A regular guest at government expense, it seems."
"So where's the crock of shit?"
"Don't you understand? If I want to question him, I'll have to put in an official request and indent for travel expenses. Have you any idea of the paperwork that would entail? It could take weeks. And all because of some vague hint from an ex-beetle and a German woman who came briefly under suspicion and has been obstructing my inquiries ever since. Madonna, they'll bust a gut laughing at the prefecture. Besides, the man's a government official. I'd be stirring up a hornet's nest again, and me with my prior history with that senator? Thanks a lot."
Poldy looked at him.
"The man may have murdered Valentino."
Montana drew a deep breath.
"I'll have a word with the German authorities tomorrow, and they can question this Dr. Tannenberger."
Poldy shook her head disapprovingly.
"What if you simply fly to Munich and ask Dr. Tannenberger a few questions?"
"Unannounced, you mean? What if he isn't there at all?"
"Have you got the internet on your smartphone?"
Yes, why?"
"Give it here."
Poldi took Montana's phone from him and keyed Dr. Frank Tannenberger, Bayerische Staatskanzlei, into the search box of his browser.
"Got him!" she exclaimed.
"Our Dr. Tannenberger, a.k.a. Mr. X, heads the Department for EU Relations at the Bayerische Staatskanzlei. If the head of department flies regularly to Sicily in person, it must be in connection with some major project. He's bound to have to report to some committee or other, so he wouldn't jet off elsewhere right away. No, believe me, he'll be sitting in his office overlooking the Hofgarten, good as gold."
Montana shook his head firmly. "It's no use anyway. An Italian policeman can't go nosing around in Germany, least of all when a German government official is involved."
"But as a private individual, what's to stop you?"
"That's a crazy idea. Nothing I discovered could be used in court. On the contrary, if this man Tannenberger claimed I'd threatened him, the whole case could go down the tubes and me with it. It'd be a crock of shit."
"You're repeating yourself, Vito. So what are you going to do?"
Montana clasped his hands together impotently to indicate that they were tied by forces beyond his control.
"I can only go through the proper channels."
Poldi thought for a moment.
"Well," she said eventually, getting to her feet, "you're probably right. We'll just have to wait and see."
"Where are you going?"
"Home. It's getting late."
"I thought we might have a drink together."
It wasn't that Poldi hadn't had the same idea, but she had certain reasons for staying sober on two levels. Besides, she was in a hurry all of a sudden.
"Another time. I'm really tired and I've got a headache coming on."
"Shall I drive you?"
"Don't worry. I left my car down in the Lumbi car park."
She leant forward and kissed Montana lightly on both cheeks.
"See you."
He caught her arm, though, and eyed her suspiciously.
"Poldi?"
"Vito."
"What are you up to?"
"Nothing. Look, I really am tired. Would you let go of me, please?"
Poldi called Louisa from her car as soon as she passed the Autostrada toll booth.
"For tomorrow morning?"
Louisa, who worked for travel agent, was taken aback.
"Do you know what time it is? Please, could you try, Louisa? But what about your... No good, I'll have to manage on my own."
Aunt Louisa wasn't the type to refuse a favour, no matter what the time was.
"I'll call you back right away. Drive carefully."
By the time Poldi reached Torre Acirafi, Louisa had managed to make the reservations online. Not for peanuts, it must be added. Poldi gulped in dismay when Louisa told her the cost of the flights. Her small pension was just enough to cover her everyday living expenses, and she had really hoped to reserve her meagre savings for urgent house repairs and other emergencies. On the other hand, she told herself, this was a kind of emergency in itself.
Never mind. She would simply be unable to afford another pair of strappy sandals this summer. The case took priority.
The flight left at 10. Catania Airport, which had long been awake, smelt of kerosene, coffee, and cornetti, and was humming a melody of wanderlust and homecoming. Extended families thronged the arrivals hall, waiting to welcome relations from Germany and Belgium, England and Denmark. As soon as the automatic doors opened, even a crack, someone always tried to squeeze through and help Alfio and Alessia get their baggage off the carousel. Young German students, patiently queuing up in front of the check-in desks, shook their heads as they were barged aside by grey-haired Sicilians with monstrous suitcases big enough to emigrate with. At the security barrier, a symbol of the Italian crisis, raised voices, gesticulating hands, everything brought to a standstill. Somebody, not Uncle Martino for once, had been found to have a shrink-wrapped octopus in his hand luggage as a gift for his nearest and dearest in Mannheim, and was loudly protesting at having to leave it behind. My Auntie Poldi groaned. Have I already told you that my Auntie Poldi was scared stiff of flying? Well, she was. She mistrusted the laws of aerodynamics, the complex technology, and above all, the young men in the cockpit and their unctuous, oh-so-reassuring in-flight announcements. She was afraid of the way airliners lurched and wobbled, of the dull roar of the engines, of air pockets and landing procedures. She detested travelling through the air cooped up at 500 miles per hour at an altitude of 5 miles with nothing but a bit of aluminium between you and a freefall, or death by asphyxia. 20 years earlier, Poldi and my Uncle Pepe had almost succumbed to the latter on a flight from Munich to Catania in a friend's small private jet, which lost cabin pressure over the Alps. They spent a quarter of an hour gasping and panting for their lives in atmospheric pressure similar to that prevailing on the summit of Annapurna. Since then, Poldi had been as averse to flying as Satan to holy water. Sometimes, however, even Satan gets splashed, and sometimes even Poldi had to bite the bullet. She normally backed up her willpower with tranquilizers, but they were precluded this time by her need to keep a clear head. Her only remaining hope was that a friendly fellow passenger would take pity on her and hold her hand. That was what Poldi and my Uncle Pepe had done at 25,000 feet, held each other's hand, the whole time. One's fear of death may not be entirely dispelled by holding someone's hand, even a total stranger's, but it helps. As befitted the occasion, Poldi was wearing a muted dark blue jumpsuit with pumps and a military blazer. For one thing, she had a penchant for uniforms, and for another, intended to look a trifle intimidating. Her huge sunglasses were suggestive of a former film star, hoping that someone will recognize her and whisper her name behind her back. She was feeling rather agitated. Because of her impending flight, of course, but also because of her forthcoming encounter with Valentino's putative murderer, and because of Munich. She wondered if it might be an omen that she was returning to her old stamping ground after only 3 months, alone and empty-handed, just as she had returned from Tanzania, distraught, with a void in her heart and her bank account. Talking of omens, when she turned away from the check-in counter, boarding card in hand, Montano was standing in front of her. She stared at him as if he were the Archangel Michael, for even without a fiery sword, Montana presented an impressive appearance that morning. He, too, was wearing dark blue, together with a white shirt and a tie, black brogues, and his usual aviator sunglasses. He looked like a cop escorting a prosecution witness to the trial of the century, grim-faced and ready for anything. In other words, sexy as hell. Or so my Auntie Poldi thought.
My!
She exclaimed. Did you seriously imagine I'd let you loose on a witness in my case?
But how did you know I was...
Montana took my flummoxed aunt by the arm and towed her out of the queue in front of the check-in desk.
From your face and the way you said we'd just have to wait and see.
Poldi liked that.
But what about going through proper channels and travel expenses and all that palaver?
Proper channels be damned. I've already been transferred once for disciplinary reasons.
Poldi liked that, too. She also liked the thought that she would be able to hold Montana's hand during the flight.
Forza, Montana!
She cried in delight.
But Montana wasn't in the mood for levity. I'm tempted to arrest you here and now and have you taken home, but sadly I can't stop you from flying to Munich. So listen, here's the deal. I, and only I, will interview Tannenberger. You will simply do a bit of interpreting and otherwise keep your trap shut.
Poldi looked at him like a schoolmistress confronted by a pupil who has asked for the heating to be turned off in February.
Nonsense,
she said, shaking her head and strode briskly to the security gate.
Coming, Vito?
The first thing Poldi did on board was ensure she could sit beside Montana and hold his hand.
I'm scared of flying,
she explained.
For the next 3 hours, you're going to make sure I don't flip.
Which is precisely what he did. He held her moist hand tightly throughout the flight and explained every aeronautical sign of life.
That's the engine starting up. We're being backed out onto the runway. When it shakes, we're taking off. The runway is long enough. That's the landing gear being retracted. Now the pilots are attracting the slats and flaps. Look, there's Etna. And there's Torre. We've now reached cruising height, that's why he's throttling back. There aren't any air pockets. No, the wing isn't broken, those are the ailerons.
How do you know all these things?
I have a pilot's license.
Poldi stared at him. From her expression, he might just have disclosed he was 007.
You have... pilot's license.
Sure. I'd be glad to take you up with me sometime.
You can forget that right away, Signor Mystery Man.
She shook her head in amazement.
A pilot's license.
And apropos of secrets.
About the other night, Montana said suddenly.
I don't want to know,
Poldy broke in.
You said it was complicated, so let's leave it at that.
Were you feeling hurt?
No. Why? We're both adults.
Aren't you curious?
Me? Not in the least.
Lie to me once more, and I'll let go of your hand.
Poldy liked that, too, that he could be amusing, that he had a way of flattering without fawning over her.
Not that she had anything against a bit of fawning in small doses.
Shut up and explain about air pockets again, will you?
From Munich Airport, they took the S-Bahn to the Hauptbahnhof, and then the U-Bahn to the Odeonsplatz. Time enough for Poldy to recover from the flight and return to stress level green. It was a warm day with a colouring book sky of blue dotted with white. Montana was amazed at all the people in pavement cafes and beer gardens.
How do you Germans run your economy if no one here works?
How do you like Munich?
How long did you live here?
Nearly all my life. Two lifetimes or three. I stopped counting after a while.
Like a cat, eh? Later on, will you show me where you used to live?
No.
But Poldy was nonetheless pleased by Montana's interest in Munich. Not just as a venue for the Oktoberfest or a fashionable shopping paradise, but as the former midpoint of her life. It made her feel rather proud and put her in a conciliatory frame of mind. The city hadn't expelled her, after all. It had merely become too small for her. She decided to explain that to Montana sometime, if he was still interested. And perhaps she would steel herself again to board a plane and show him her favourite places. A nice idea, come to think of it. The next moment they were standing in front of the impressive building that housed the Bavarian State Chancellery.
Is this it?
In all its glory, yes.
Let's try our luck, then.
Montana strode resolutely towards the main entrance, but Poldy held him back.
Not so fast. Do we have a phone number for the man?
Montana handed her the printout from the Timeo. Poldy dialed the number given on the hotel registration form.
Yes, said an impatient voice after the third ring.
Herr Tannenberger?
Who is this?
The irritable tone of someone under pressure.
My name is Oberreiter. I've just come from Sicily. I missed you at the Timeo, unfortunately.
Where did you get my number? What's this about, anyway?
It's about Valentino. You know, you were at his funeral. A few issues have arisen in connection with his death, and I'd like to resolve them with you.
Silence reigned at the other end of the line. Then...
What sort of issues?
I'd sooner discuss them with you in person, and it would be helpful if you could manage it right away, before you fly off to Panama or Cuba.
That's impossible. I don't have the time.
Outside the main entrance in 5 minutes, all right? Because if you don't come, I'll have to speak to the police at once.
The man at the other end of the line cleared his throat. Where are you now?
Where I said, just outside. Practical, no?
Is he coming?
Montana asked when Poldy ran off.
5 minutes.
What did you say?
She gave him a broad smile.
Abracadabra.
The red-haired man appeared less than 5 minutes later. Poldy recognized him at once and gave him a wave like one colleague meeting another for lunch. Tannenberger, wearing a dark business suit, appeared taller to Poldy than he had at the funeral. He stopped short when he saw Montana, but Poldy hurried over to him before he could dive back into the building.
"Hello there, Dr. Tannenberger," she said cheerfully. "Glad you could manage it. I'm Frau Oberreiter. I just had the pleasure of speaking to you on the phone, and this is Commissario Montana of the State Police in Aciriale. He's the senior investigating officer in the Valentino Candela case."
"I didn't think the police would be present."
"They aren't. Commissario Montana is here in an entirely private capacity. If he wasn't, your department wouldn't be notified by now, so it's up to you."
Tannenberger reluctantly shook Montana's hand, but remained tense, as though ready to run at any moment. He wasn't wearing a ring, Poldy noted, but his wrist was adorned with a showy officini panerai, hardly a typical civil servant's wristwatch at a measly €10,000. Tannenberger turned to Poldy.
And who exactly are you?
A sort of interpreter for Commissario Montana, let's say.
What does sort of mean?
She was a friend of Valentino's, Montana said in English, determined to get at least one word in.
Why, I couldn't have put it better myself,
Poldi exclaimed.
I snapped you together shortly before his death, do you remember? At the cafe in Taormina.
Tannenberger looked back at the State Chancellery like someone watching an ocean liner about to sail off at full speed without him. Then he glanced at his Panerai.
I can spare half an hour. Let's go into the Hofgarten.
He didn't utter another word until they had found a vacant park bench in the shade of an old chestnut tree, but he kicked off at once before Montana had a chance to ask him a single question, and Poldi translated.
Let me make one thing clear from the start. I did not kill Valentina. I was here in Munich on the day of his death, as you can easily check. I even have witnesses for the relevant time. All I would ask is that you proceed discreetly. I'm in a permanent relationship, you see.
Having waited for Poldi to translate this statement, he turned to her and went on before Montana could step in.
I remember you taking that photo. It was on my last evening with Valentina. I had to return here the following morning.
Valentino was rather dismayed when he caught sight of you. He wanted to run after you, but I stopped him.
Tannenberger paused for a moment, as though drained of strength by this revelation, and waited for Poldi to translate again.
You can't imagine how shocked I am by Valentino's death.
I feel as if my heart has been ripped out, but I can't afford to grieve for him openly.
He trembled suddenly,
but pulled himself together at once. Poldi guessed what was coming.
I first met Valentino about 6 months ago, on my first official trip to Taormina. He was carrying drinks around at a reception, one of his part-time jobs. It was love at first sight. For me, at least. I never really fathomed his feelings.
Tannenberger paused again and looked at Montana.
What do you want to know?
Who killed him?
I don't know. I didn't learn of his death until I returned to Sicily. That was the day before his funeral.
Who told you?
Signor Patenay.
What's your relationship with Signor Patenay?
He wants to tender for the construction of an international cultural center in Taormina under the auspices of the European Union, to be co-financed by the Bavarian Free State.
And what was the relationship between Patenay and Valentino?
Valentino worked for him occasionally, as far as I could gather. It was he that introduced us, anyway. An extremely unpleasant, tiresome individual. He has no chance of getting the contract, and he keeps pestering me with invitations and offers to sell me houses or construction sites in prime locations, on so-called special terms, but that sort of thing doesn't work with me.
In what capacity did Valentino work for Patenay?
I don't know. Valentino had numerous jobs. He was no fool. He wanted to come to Germany and make a life for himself here.
Yes, Poldi remembered that. She remembered her German lessons with Valentino. His ambition. His optimism.
Did that alarm you? She asked. I mean, because of your permanent relationship.
I wanted nothing more. And that's the truth. I was crazy about Valentino. I would have squared it with my partner.
But you didn't.
Tannenberger didn't reply. Montana nodded when Poldi had translated for him. He seemed convinced.
The last time you met, he resumed, did Valentino strike you as different in any way?
Yes, he seemed nervous somehow, but he flatly refused to tell me what was wrong. Only that he had to settle a few things before he could come to Germany.
What sort of things?
I don't have the faintest idea. Did he mention old mosaics?
Poldi asked.
Or lions?
Lions?
Yes, you know, stone figures guarding the entrances to old country houses.
Tannenberger shook his head.
Not that I recall. Did you get the impression that he might be involved in something? Something illegal, I mean.
Yes, in a way. As I said, he wouldn't talk about it.
But?
Well, he once said something along those lines. That he'd discovered something and that someone would pay him a lot of money to keep quiet about it.
You don't say. What had he discovered?
who was going to pay him a lot of money?
He wouldn't tell me. He merely said I wasn't to worry.
And didn't you?
My God, what do you think? I was in love with Valentino. Of course I was worried, but what could I do?
You could have gone to the police when you heard about his death, said Montana.
Tannenberger said nothing. His mobile bleeped. He glanced at the display and killed the call.
I must go. Any more questions?
It's possible I may yet have to question you officially, said Montana,
or request my German colleagues to do so. If anything else occurs to you in the next few days...
He handed Tannenberger his card.
No matter what, maybe a chance remark of Valentino's, a triviality, anything at all, please call me.
Or me, Poldi put in. And I'll pass it on to the commissario. You now have my number in your call records. Isolde Oberreiter. All clear.
Tannenberger pocketed Montana's card, rose to his feet, and hurriedly shook hands with Poldi and Montana. He obviously couldn't wait to return to his secure habitat, the State Chancellery. But then Poldi thought of something else.
One more thing,
she called after Tannenberger.
Do you still have Valentino's mobile number?
Yes, of course, but I didn't manage to reach him on either of his numbers after our last meeting.
If you'd be kind enough to give me them.
5 minutes later, the unfortunate Herr Tannenberger was back in his office. Poldi and Montana were still sitting on the park bench, and it was still a fine day. Even finer, perhaps, than it had been a few minutes earlier. While Poldi was preening herself on her investigatory success, Montana was calling a colleague at police headquarters in Ashireale.
Gaetano, I want you to trace and check on a mobile phone for me. Got something to write with?
He dictated the second number on the slip of paper in his hand.
Repeat that. Good. I need the works, present location, most recent calls, text messages, all the radio cells from the day before Valentino Candela's murder up to today. In Munich. But I'll be back tonight.
Don't ask stupid questions. Just do as I say.
Damn it, Tanner. Then get a decision. This is the second mobile, the one we've been looking for all this time. I'll explain it all to you tomorrow. And Tanner, don't mess around. This is important, okay?
He rang off and grinned at Poldi.
Our little trip may have paid off after all.
No, Vito. What you really meant to say was, I'm so glad you came with me, Poldi. Many thanks. If it weren't for you, I wouldn't have made such progress.
Montana lit a cigarette, blew some smoke rings into the summer sky, and then looked at her.
Well, what shall we do with what's left of the day?
Although this wasn't exactly the answer Poldi had wanted to hear, she did detect a certain promising subtext. This, together with her little triumph and the Bavarian blue and white of the beautiful sky, raised her spirits and whetted her appetite for roast pork and life.
"What do you feel like? Sweet or salty?" she asked.
"Both."
If that wasn't an innuendo, she didn't know what was. Some roast pork plus a dumpling and two beers later, however, they had to head back to the airport. Gaetano didn't call, but Montana seemed unworried. To Poldi's delight, he made a far more relaxed, almost light-hearted impression, recounted amusing anecdotes about his police work, and questioned her about her various Munich lives. And although Poldi didn't find his interest in her past the least bit feigned, she realized that he was drawing a veil of charm and gaiety over himself, a pleasant tissue of elusive levity, delicate but impenetrable. He never once made physical contact with her, not even fleetingly or as if by accident. He kept her at arm's length and swathed himself in a shadow as dark and deep as a lake at night, and too intimidating to penetrate with a word. Or a kiss, thought Poldi, and that depressed her once more. On board the plane, though, Montana immediately did his chivalrous duty again. He held my aunt's hand and lectured her on the physics of flight, meteorology and landing procedures. When they landed at Catania shortly before 9, Poldi felt as if she'd been away for an age. Stranger still, she felt pleased to be home again. Home. A key word.
Need a lift? Montana asked as they emerged from the airport building like two helpless tourists whose luggage hadn't accompanied them.
I've got my own car here.